Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 1st, 2005. This session, Learning Global Stewardship, Acid Rain and Ozone Depletion, presented by Philip Mote in the Fireside Room, disc number MOP-25-01.
In a series on global environmental challenges and their solutions, if you were here for the Making Congregations Work session, that's next door. First, I want to plug a couple of books that I suggested the bookstore stock on these issues. The first is called Stormy Weather, 101 Solutions to Global Climate Change. So it's a fairly upbeat look at what could be done. And the second book is called The Future of Life by Edward O. Wilson, a fascinating read about the problem of species depletion, species extinction, which we'll get to later in the week. They're both very interesting books. They're both in paperback, so they shouldn't be terribly expensive. $13 for this one and $20 for this one. I'm, in addition to being a research scientist at the University of Washington, focusing on climate of the Pacific Northwest, I'm also Washington's state climatologist, and so and I've got my 13-year-old son Nat up being my remote clicker up on the second level, so I'll be cueing him like right now to go to the next slide. So a word from the state climatologist. I don't know if you've noticed this weather station just outside the snack bar over here. This is Holden's official weather station. And it's a fairly unusual location, as you can imagine, Holden being in an unusual location. And this was the original, what they call cotton region shelter. It's just a shelter for the thermometer to keep it from being too hot on sunny days. That has been replaced by this device, which is an electronic, what's called MMTS, minimum maximum temperature sensor. And inside Narnia is a little display that tells what the daily max and min temperatures were, and those are written down on cards sent into the National Climate Data Center, and they become the official record of what happened at Holden Village. And then we can call up, for instance, at the Western Regional Climate Center and look at the climatology of Holden Village. So for each month, the average maximum temperature, so for August, the average high would be 77.5, and of course, yesterday we had the last in a string of very warm days. Average minimum temperatures, you can see that even in the summer it's quite chilly typically. And average total monthly precipitation, we're in the dry time of year here. Actually, July is the driest time of year. And snowfall, even in May, it can snow. And the average snow depth in May is 3 inches. And the average annual snow depth is 19 inches. Average total snowfall is over 20 feet. And if you've seen the pictures of Holden in the winter, you'll appreciate just what a different place it is in the winter. The next slide shows Holden's climatology on a daily time scale. These measurements incidentally date back to the arrival of the team that began outfitting Holden for public occupation, and one of the first things they did was activate this weather station. And this just shows the average maximum temperature, so you can see the peak is right around my wife's birthday at the end of July, and we're already heading toward winter now. So I'm talking about global environmental challenges. This is really a 21st century issue. In the 19th and 20th centuries, we came to grips with local environmental problems, and these are some obvious ones. Smog, this is a comparative picture of a smoggy day and a clear day in a typical city. We're all familiar with the problem of smog, visible haze being one manifestation, but the invisible pollutants are just as damaging. Water pollution, of course, it's not typically this bad, but of course the canal that caught fire in the 1960s was a sort of galvanizing time for concern over local environmental issues. And then strip mining, of course, an issue in the West where entire mountains would just be stripped away to get out the the minerals underneath. The example we have here in Holden of the lingering tailings, obviously not as bad as strip mining, but it is clearly not the way it started out. These kinds of local issues kind of caught hold of people, and because they so visibly affect the quality of life, there was a great deal of political will over time to tackling them. And often there was a single culprit who was responsible for the pollution or for the environmental damage, the strip mining, whatever. And it just became a matter of getting the political will to deal with that one culprit or a few culprits, and the problem could be solved. So in a way, although it may have been difficult to muster the political will, in a sense it was simple. Simple doesn't mean easy. It does mean that the solutions could be worked out fairly straightforwardly. So what about these global issues? This is a cartoon from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. I don't care what they say, global warming is a bunch of loony left-wing environmentalist anti-growth hype. And she's saying, so is this your first winter here in Juneau? there are a number of cartoons, and I'll show some of them during the course of the week, sort of poking fun at the notion of global warming, or in this case, of the notion that global warming is, as he says, just a bunch of loony left-wing environmentalist anti-growth hype. In fact, I think this cartoon says a lot about what we're dealing with this week, because the human race is accustomed to a fairly local perspective. If you read some biblical passages where it talks about the whole world, it's pretty clear that it's, you know, from the sea on the west to the river on the east, from the Mediterranean to the Euphrates, which is a distance of less than 200 miles, and this spanned the whole known world. And the same was true of pollution problems really up until the 1970s, which we'll explore a little later. But there's this sort of sense of denial. How can we possibly be having such a grand effect on the planet? So part of what I want to do today is kind of set the stage for what we're doing later in the week with these global problems, which in contrast with the local problems, they're often not readily visible. We have to have some kind of special instruments or special analysis to figure out that they're happening. The causes, it's not so easy to just point to a single culprit and say, oh well, you know, W.R. Grace Mining Company caused this problem. It's often permeates the economy. And because there are so many players, it's very difficult to solve, difficult to handle the sorts of behind the scenes negotiating and lobbying and so on that prevent meaningful action. This is the outline of where I'm going to go this week. Today we're talking both about learning global stewardship from a biblical perspective and also from a practical perspective, how the acid rain and ozone depletion problems were largely solved or partly solved. And then we'll have a series of three lectures about global climate change beyond the day after tomorrow, which is sort of a focus on what we know about the science, best tomorrow, and then global climate change in the world's poor on Wednesday, which is a discussion really from a kind of a moral standpoint as well as a scientific standpoint of how these issues, this issue affects the world's poor. On Thursday, I'll talk about the United States' stance on climate change. It's fairly easily caricatured, but in fact, the truth is a bit more nuanced. So I'll try to outline what's happening there. And then finally, on Friday, we'll talk about the issue that E.O. Wilson brings up in his book about species extinctions, which I call undoing creation. So let's start out with some biblical perspectives. Could you click again? I think there's supposed to be a heading for some reason. Oh yes, okay, so I'm gonna quickly run through a few Bible verses that I think just set the stage for thinking about these things from a biblical perspective. And I've spent a lot of time sort of reading through the Bible and looking at different verses, and I'm not trying to present a biased view, but one that I think represents the various types of themes that come out in biblical passages. So the first set of themes I'm calling God created nature and gave it purpose. So, for example, in Genesis 1, God called the dry, he created each thing, and God saw that it was good. So there's an intrinsic goodness in these Genesis 1 passages. He created something, he called it good. It has intrinsic goodness. In Psalm 19, verses 1 to 4, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech, night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. So there's a sense in which the creation serves a function in praising the Creator. Another part of that theme in Genesis 1:26, God said, "Let us make humans in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So there's a role for humans within creation. And on and then Psalm 104. He makes the clouds his chariot and rides on the wings of the wind. He makes winds his messengers, flames of fire his servants. So there's a sense in which he has sovereignty over creation and over specific aspects of creation. Let's go to the next slide. So from Genesis 1:28, again, God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Genesis 2:15, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. And Psalm 8, verses 3 to 8, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all flocks and herds, the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, and the fish of the sea, all that swim the paths of the sea. And I think it's pretty clear from this set of passages that God granted authority over the created world to humans. So we're not simply an adjunct to creation, but that we have a special role to fulfill in relation to the created world. Let's go to the next set. Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. For he founded it upon the seas and established it upon the waters. And then back to Psalm 104. How many are your works, O Lord? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. There is the sea, vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number, living things both large and small. And then Leviticus 25. Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you enter the land I'm going to give you, the land itself must observe a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years sow your fields, and for 6 years prune your vineyards and gather your crops. But in the seventh year the land is to have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Do not sow your fields or prune your vineyards. Do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the grapes of your untended vines. The land is to have a year of rest. So I think it's also clear that God retains title to the created world. The psalmist speaks of the creatures as God's creatures, and God gives these very specific instructions about letting the land rest every seventh year. So there are clearly limits to what humans can and should do. So and then the last theme that I think it's the last theme. That I think scriptures teach us. Genesis 7:21-23. This is immediately after the flood. Every living thing that moved on the earth perished. Birds, livestock, wild animals, all the creatures that swarm over the earth, and all mankind. And some other passages as well. And then Isaiah 24. See, the Lord is going to lay waste the earth and devastate it. He will ruin its face and scatter its inhabitants. The earth will be completely laid waste and totally plundered. And this is in response to the sin of the Israelites. And similarly, in Isaiah 11, a shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse, from his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding. And then farther down, this image, the wolf will live with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. Okay, yeah. And from these passages and also Romans 8, which I won't read, it's clear that there is a sense in which the sins of humans are manifest in punishment that also includes the earth, and that the creation itself suffers from human sin, and the Romans passage talks about how the creation will enjoy redemption at the same time. So the themes that I think come out of Scripture as we think about stewardship creation, first of all, God created nature and gave it purpose. It has intrinsic goodness, quite independent of humans. Second, God granted authority over the created world to humans, not authority to abuse, but authority for a specific purpose. And that purpose is to tend it as a gardener tends a garden, so that it will produce what it needs to produce in order to sustain all life. Some of the passages are about the intricate way in which the plants and the animals depend on each other for sustenance and in turn on God in his grand design. The third point is crucial. It's that God retains title to the created world. And I think it's impossible to read these scriptures and come away with the notion that it's ours to do with as we want, the sort of James Watt philosophy, if you remember back in the 1980s. Well, it's all going to burn anyway, so we may as well take what we can get while we can. And finally, the created world suffers because of human sin and will share in redemption. So there's a sense in which it is a spiritual sibling to us, and as siblings are sometimes jointly punished for the misdeeds of a single one, sometimes creation also is punished or suffers because of our sin. Are there any comments or discussions about this biblical view that I've laid out of stewardship? I'm obviously not a theologian, I'm a scientist, so I may have made some major mistakes, which I'm happy to have pointed out. Well, let's go ahead then with the more science-y part of it. I want to give you two, I think, sort of happy examples of, some lessons from this, implications for these global issues. First of all, humans have a responsibility to keep creation in good working order, because creation has a role to fill in providing sustenance. There's another issue of international and intergenerational justice. That is, as we begin to understand the ways in which the global environment is connected, the actions that we take in, for example, Washington State or Iowa or wherever you're from, have a global implication, and not just now, but generations down the road. And it's also clear that the people of God have special perspectives, that we have a different view of creation because of what we see in the Bible and the tradition of the Christian faith. So we have special obligations from our understanding. So I want to talk about success stories. These global environmental problems can be very depressing, and so I've called them global environmental challenges and their solutions. And today we're going to talk about the success stories, acid rain and ozone depletion. For both of these, there was a common pattern that scientists began to perceive that something was amiss and gave some picture of what was happening to policymakers, and somehow the media and the public got involved and people began to be concerned. And then gradually some businesses began to see that for whatever reason it was in their best interest to be on the right side of this issue, and eventually solutions were enacted and were followed. So let's take the acid rain, or more generally acid deposition problem first. There's a natural balance of things going into the atmosphere and things coming out of the atmosphere. But by burning particularly coal, but also other things, we produce what are called NOx, that's nitrogen oxides, NO and NO2, and also sulfur dioxide, SO2. And both of these either can just sort of directly fall out as gaseous substances and just accumulate on any surface, or they can also be oxidized to form sulfuric acid or nitric acid, and then you've got these acids floating around in the atmosphere, and they're very easily absorbed into clouds, where they can fall then as acid rain or acid snow. And there's also, of course, natural sources that can produce acid rain, but in far less abundance than when we're pumping these things in. So that's the sort of basic science of how these things get into the atmosphere. Just to refresh your memory, if high school or college chemistry was a very long time ago, the scale, the pH scale on which we measure the acidity of something is neutral at 7, and then the smaller the number, the more acidic it is, and then the more basic it is for larger numbers. Of course, we're not going to talk about large numbers. Typically, rain is slightly acidic with a pH between 5 and 6. Wine is down here around 4, and some ponds have been measured at a pH of 4, which is like wine. So there's probably some way to work the parable of Jesus turning water to wine there, but I'm not imaginative enough to do it. So what happens when this acid precipitation lands on the soil and percolates through into the streams, it actually leaches aluminum out of the soil, which is present in very small quantities. And both the aluminum itself and the acid are toxic to fish. And so there are various bad things that happen to fish. For moderately low acidity, most fish eggs will not hatch, so it disrupts the reproductive cycle. It also weakens trees and other plants by damaging their leaves, very sensitive structures. And it alters the soil chemistry, so soils can actually become saturated in nitrogen and throw things off balance for plants that way. There's no direct harm to humans, but the pollutants themselves are harmful. Fertilizers and other soil treatments can be used to protect crops from acid rain, rebalancing the soil chemistry. Of course, this was an acute problem back in the 19th century, the damage done to buildings, particularly bronze and certain kinds of stone with a fairly basic chemical composition. There's been some controversy over this, but there appears to be evidence that it may damage auto paint. You can actually have, out of a really acidic precipitation, you end up with these little droplet-shaped discolorations on cars. So the effects, though, on the environment obviously depend on the exposure, on how long and how bad the exposure has been. When snowmelt occurs, and then you get a sort of accumulated quantity of water released into streams, you can get this acid shock where the acidity goes up rapidly. And of course, it also depends on the sediment or bedrock type. Calcium or magnesium are more on the basic end, so acid precipitation falling into them is sort of neutralized, and then downstream there wouldn't be such an issue. Granitic rocks, like you find in the Sierras and parts of the Rockies, tend to be acidic, so those rocks have a more susceptibility to it. And the northeastern U.S. and southeast Canada have this sort of triple whammy, that they have a high amount of inputs of the NOx and the SO2. They have a lot of snowmelt in the spring, of course, And then they also have a very granitic soil structure. So all of these things add up to make the problem more acute in the Northeast than it is out West. Already in the 17th century, scientists were beginning to realize the potential for acid precipitation to be more acute in some places, and the term acid rain was coined back in 1882. So already some environmental concern. And then a series of small efforts beginning in the mid-50s, mainly in the U.S., but also some in Europe, and culminating in the Clean Air Act of 1970, one of several environmental legacies left by President Nixon. The EPA was created, the Environmental Protection Agency, and it was given the task of dealing with this, and it ended up setting targets for each state, and then the states had to come up with a plan for tackling the problem. And so each state had its own opportunity to plan what would work best for that state. Well, unfortunately, it didn't work too well in the 70s and 80s. These state plans were fairly ineffective. And so in 1990, the Clean Air Act was amended to put more teeth into this effort to reduce acid rain. And what was introduced was a fairly innovative system where there were a list of 111 specifically named power plants that were each given a limit for how much they could emit. And they were allowed, if they managed to get below that limit, they were allowed to trade or sell the credit that they earned by being cleaner. So a dirtier plant could buy credits from a cleaner plant and thereby sort of reach an overall level of reduction in a more cost-effective way. And the phase two came in the late 90s, and it went beyond these original plants, and it required utilities to reduce emissions by an additional 50%. So let's see how much this cost. This is an interesting book by Eben Goodstein, a professor at Lewis and Clark in Portland. Unfortunately, very well known by a certain alumna who was an intern with President Clinton. So he looked at these industry predictions of job losses, and for some reason the colors came out funny here, but you could find in the trade journals claims that enacting these amendments would cost 250,000 jobs, that it was just going to wipe out the coal industry and a whole lot of associated jobs. And so Eben then went through and looked at all the records of job losses in several states, county by county, and found that the actual total was 7,000 jobs lost. So and this doesn't even count the jobs created through the demand for new technology. In this book, Eben points out that industry has a history of exaggerating how difficult it will be for them to meet a certain environmental regulation. He goes on to posit that the claims that global warming legislation would destroy 500,000 jobs or whatever are probably also exaggerated by similarly large factors, factor of 50 or whatever. All right, so let's see how effective this was. This is a map of the acidity of various ponds, streams, and lakes that were monitored. And this is the map for 1994, and you can see the pH scale here on the right. Basically, everything that's green is in the normal range of above 5. So this is sort of what you'd expect in a clean environment. And you can see that in the northeastern U.S., there are a lot of places that are down 4.2, 4.1. So that's getting toward that water turning into wine level of acidity. Fast forward to 2002, very considerable improvement in the Northeast. Most of these places are about 3/10 of a pH unit better than they were. Not much change in the Southeast. And obviously the West is still in pretty good shape, but a lot of these places got cleaner as well. So sort of evaluating the learning experience of acid rain, by targeting one type of source, initially just these sulfur-burning power plants, or coal-burning power plants that had sulfur in them, sulfur dioxide emissions have been reduced by about a third, which obviously had a big benefit in the Northeast. However, these reductions have not been universal. I mean, well, one drawback of the cap and trade system is that if you're in a particularly acute sensitive area and you just buy your emissions somewhere else, your emissions reduction somewhere else, then all you've done is left your problem in place and exported the solution and the benefits somewhere else. And in particular, the Southern Appalachians have not improved. So clearly, we're partway there, but further reductions are needed to get the eastern third of the country up to sort of normal acidity levels.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Is that because of a lack of competition as far as the power plants in the Appalachians?
I don't know the details of why there. I think it was just a little more expensive to reduce there, so it was cheaper for them to buy emissions elsewhere. And for other problems, like, as we'll see in a minute, for ozone depletion, it doesn't matter where in the world something is emitted because that's globally well mixed. But these acid compounds are only as long-lived as it takes for them to find a cloud, which is typically, you know, hundreds of miles at most. So, yeah.
The power plants down in Appalachia are probably burning the high sulfur coal that's local down there. And most of the other power plants have switched to low sulfur western coal. Mm.
But my concern was there doesn't seem to be a lot of motivation to change that.
Well, I think that's where phase two comes in.
You
take the first step and sort of pick out the low-hanging fruit, and then go to the second step and expand. Any other questions before we move on to ozone depletion, which is a grander problem? Okay, let's go ahead. So a little bit of science on ozone. So ozone floats around in the atmosphere and protects life from the extreme ultraviolet, which, unlike the mild sunburn you get from UVB, would kill you pretty fast. And in fact, life only managed to arise on land after a considerable amount of time had gone by of producing oxygen in the oceans to the point where ozone could be created in sufficient abundance to protect Earth from UVA. As we'll see, this natural balance of ozone production and destruction was upset by chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs. And this initial concern about what CFCs might be doing, which percolated along in the 70s, as we'll see, was really accelerated by the discovery of the ozone hole. And in the space of just 10 years, from 1985, when the ozone hole was discovered, to 1995, the production of CFCs has essentially ceased globally. So this is, I think, a very good success story because the problem is largely solved. Okay, so let's hit the science briefly. The sun, these very energetic photons of UVA break down oxygen molecules, O2 molecules, to create single, very reactive oxygen atoms. They'll bump around and react with almost anything they can find. If they bump into an oxygen molecule, they will form ozone, O3. And so there's a balance between O2 and O3. And then ozone is lost by a reaction of the oxygen atom or the ozone molecule with each other or with some of the trace gas. So there's a sort of cycling between O3 and O2 and oxygen atoms. So there's a natural balance between production and destruction. Now, the destruction is most prevalent with in this catalytic form. And if you don't remember in high school chemistry, I'll walk you through this. The symbols here are some molecule or atom X reacts with ozone to produce an oxide of X. So XO plus our harmless, helpful oxygen molecule that we breathe. Then this XO reacts with another ozone molecule to produce an X, whatever we started out with, and two oxygen molecules. So if you add up what happened, you find that basically two ozone molecules turn into three oxygen molecules. And this X is free to do the same thing again. There are various natural substances that fulfill this role of destroying ozone. Oxides of hydrogen, HOX, and oxides of nitrogen, NOX. And this concern about dumping a lot of extra HOX into the stratosphere helped mix the supersonic transport back in 1971. So the idea that you'd have this fleet of supersonic jets flying at very high altitudes, dumping HOX into the atmosphere, was one of the concerns that led the U.S., but not Europe, to mix the supersonic transport. Initially, there was essentially no way to get chlorine into the stratosphere where it might destroy ozone. But there was some concern about launches from the space shuttle, which turned out to be pretty trivial compared with the other way to get chlorine into the stratosphere. Ozone was discovered in 1839, and by 1900, scientists figured out that there must be huge amounts of it up in the stratosphere just by looking at the ultraviolet absorption. All the way back in 1880, CFCs were invented and produced. And it wasn't until the 1960s that there was some concern about what might happen if we lost ozone, even though none had been lost. Would somebody near the door mind shutting it? Thanks. But DuPont, which was one of the world's major manufacturers of CFCs, wondered after they'd been producing it for several decades where these CFCs were going. You know, they just go out the door in canisters, and they didn't really know what would happen. So they started looking into it, they were kind of shocked to find out that they were accumulating in the atmosphere. And they were not too pleased about this. Sherry Rowland and Mario Molina, in a paper in 1974, wrote a paper that in which they said, you know, chlorofluorocarbons must be entering the stratosphere because they're so non-reactive. This is why they're accumulating in the atmosphere. And because they're not reactive, there's nothing that can tear them apart. And because they're not water-soluble, they don't rain out like all these pollutants that we're worried about with acid rain. So if they aren't raining out, and there's no way to react them out, they must be leaking up into the stratosphere. And that, it turns out, is a very efficient way to get chlorine into the stratosphere and accelerate ozone depletion. Roland Molina eventually won a Nobel Prize for this paper. And they're the only atmospheric scientists ever to win a Nobel Prize. There is, of course, no Nobel Prize in atmospheric science. It's physics or chemistry, and theirs was in chemistry. So this was sort of a landmark event. The scientists said, hey, you know, these CFCs could gradually deplete the ozone layer.
Wait, so the DuPont company or whatever?
Yeah.
They were manufacturing the CFCs. And they were responsible enough to actually conduct research.
Yeah. Yeah, and it turns out that, as we'll see, that the DuPont and Dow ended up being the good guys. Because once they realize the problem, yes, they're...
I wonder if everybody knows what CFCs were used in.
Oh, good point, yeah. So they were used for a whole range of things. They were used as propellants in spray cans, aerosol spray cans. And we'll actually get to that in a minute. Let's go to the next... So they were used as aerosol spray cans, and in the 70s, the U.S. addressed that specific use and said, actually specific states banned the sale of CFC aerosols. They were responsible for about 50% of CFC production. They're easily replaced by other things. Unfortunately, those other things were flammable. And the nice thing about CFCs was they weren't flammable. So just in the space of a few years, starting with these two states, and then fairly rapidly other states, the CFCs involved with aerosols, aerosol sprays, plummeted 75%. So big response with this easy low-hanging fruit. Now there were a lot of other applications for CFCs. They're used as refrigerants, both in refrigerators and air conditioners. They're used as a cleansing agent for the manufacture of silicon chips and a whole lot more. And it was these other uses that were a little harder to tackle. A fairly brief effort by industry to confuse people claimed that volcanoes produce chlorine and therefore we shouldn't worry about CFCs. And this was an example, as we'll see later in the week, of a sort of a half-truth. Well, yes, it's true that volcanoes produce chlorine, but they produce it primarily in hydrochloric acid, which is water-soluble. So if you think of a great, you know, volcanic plume, all of the water droplets in that are eventually going to form clouds, and they're going to absorb things like hydrochloric acid, and very little of that would get into the stratosphere. And furthermore, the amount of chlorine production by volcanoes is significantly less than CFC production. So it was a case of, well, yes, but. And they fairly quickly gave that up. Some companies quickly introduced substitutes. They saw which way the wind was blowing, and they said, they realized we've got to get on the right side of this issue, and so they introduced substitutes for CFCs and began to market those. And as you can see, this fantastic response by the U.S. consumer public meant that people were very interested in this. Now, an interesting side note on this, the U.S. government went ahead and just totally banned CFCs in aerosols in 1978, but all the way into the 1990s, a lot of consumers would not buy aerosol spray cans because they believed that they destroyed the ozone layer, even though that had not been true since 1978. But you know, people were on board and they were trying to do the right thing. So from this spray can ban in 1978 to 1985, there was a bit of a response by Europe, but the U.S. was really leading the way, and this had a lot to do with the U.S. dominance of the production. And particularly production of substitutes. In the late 70s, there was this discussion about regulating all CFCs going beyond the aerosols, but the industry was beginning to resist, not so much the production industry, but the consumer industries that saw that anything else would be more expensive. Then there seemed to be no substantial change in the amount of ozone, and the problem was that they were using very old instruments, and they were saying, well, the model change should only be about 1 to 2%. And then in 1985, something happened that totally changed the approach to the ozone problem, and that was the discovery of the ozone hole. Now, the ozone hole is not a quite a hole in the sense of, you know, a hole in the ground, but it is a hole in the ozone layer. If you imagine these molecules of ozone distributed through 10 miles of atmosphere, that's roughly the space they occupy, if you could condense all that ozone down into a layer, it would only be about an inch thick, about 3 centimeters thick globally. So there's very little of it in a sense. This map, satellite view of ozone for 1987, shows the normal levels around the Southern Ocean, the South Atlantic and South Pacific, of sort of 350 of these units. But right here over Antarctica is this striking hole in the ozone layer of only around 200 or even in the middle, 150 of these units. So half as much as there should be. And it turns out, as we'll see in a moment, it's very seasonal. It appears in August or September, and it goes away in November. This is the monthly average ozone over Antarctica dating back to the 1950s. And you can see it was around the 1970s when it really started to take a plunge. So something happened, and that was the accumulation of CFCs. This is the maps for each October from 1980 to 1991, and you can see that there are some years when it's worse than others. Odd-numbered years for a while were worse than even-numbered years, and I could explain the reason for that, but it's a little too complicated. So let's watch this little movie of the ozone hole developing. This is August, getting into September. You can see very low values appearing in September, continuing into October, and then in the beginning of November, it's starting to break up, and that low ozone air is just going to be mixed and distributed in the southern hemisphere, and the ozone hole will be gone. So it forms each year and it goes away each year. But this was a shock, because no scientist had predicted that this would happen, and suddenly here was this phenomenally dramatic change in the ozone layer. Yeah.
So it happens more towards in December, and is that because that's when it's closer to the sun?
It happens, it begins in late August, and yes, it's because of the sun. It turns out that the only way that the chlorine in the CFCs can react with ozone is if it's broken down on the surface of ice particles. Mm-hmm. So you need ice particles so that the stratosphere has to be cold enough, and it's only cold enough over Antarctica, not over the Arctic. Occasionally it's cold enough over the Arctic. So, but you also need sunlight to drive this reaction.
Right.
So you're exactly right. It's when spring arrives over Antarctica in August, September, that this catalytic reaction really takes off.
And so with the melting of ice sheets and things like that, glaciers eventually will...
Well, unfortunately, it's a lot more complicated than that. The changes at the surface don't have a whole lot to do with what's happening up at the layer of the ozone hole.
But a lot of the UV rays will be bounced off like that.
True. They would be, but most of the life is above, it's on the surface. Yeah. So let's go on to the next. Once this happened, this was such a shock that these negotiations that had been going on for several years and really not gotten anywhere suddenly produced some action. So in 1986, this European alliance suddenly supported a freeze. And again, it's interesting that the U.S. was really out in front on this. The U.S. favored a 95% reduction. They were willing, the U.S. was willing to do it with or without Europe. There was some congressional support for such a drastic measure. But in 1987, this Montreal Protocol was negotiated. It called for a 50% cut in CFC production by 1998. So this was less aggressive than some have been talking about, but it was something that the developed countries could all agree on. Well. Through a series of amendments to the Montreal Protocol, this goal of a 50% cut was very dramatically ratcheted down so that by 1995, it was essentially completely eliminated. And this is a prediction of the amount of chlorine in the stratosphere. This is the observed level up to 1990. This is the Montreal Protocol. This was the goal of the Montreal Protocol, and then the London Amendment in 1990. The Copenhagen Amendment in 1992 and 1997. So it turns out we are turning the corner, not quite as fast as predicted, but roughly as shown in this graph. Of course, these molecules will last 50, 100, 200 years. So simply stopping putting them up there doesn't make the problem go away. And we've bought an ozone problem for subsequent generations, but at least we've done what we can to solve it. So why was the Montreal Protocol so successful? It was through dramatic US leadership, broad public support for the cuts, as exemplified by the huge switch in aerosols. The Senate was fully behind this. The scientific assessments were very clear. There was sort of a rock-solid case for the role of CFCs in depleting the ozone layer, and particularly in the ozone hole. Industry, despite a sort of initial PR campaign to discredit the science, fairly rapidly came on board as part of the assessment process, discussing what was possible. How fast can we introduce replacements? And those... The industry efforts were in a very positive sense of helping lay out the timeline and what types of policies would be most effective and least costly. And finally, what made this work was that nobody really noticed. You know, if your brand new air conditioner is running on HFCs instead of CFCs, you wouldn't know the difference. The performance is the same. It might cost $5 more, but on a $500 air conditioner or refrigerator, you wouldn't really notice that. So the consumers at the end of the production pipeline really couldn't tell that anything was different about the replacements for CFCs. As we get into the issue of global climate change, we'll see that a lot of these things are very different, and that's part of why that's a tougher nut to crack. So the international agreements to solve these global environmental problems clearly are possible. The role of public support is absolutely critical, particularly when stoked by some imaginative pictures presented by environmental organizations and conveyed by the media. But this also cannot be done without vigorous participation by the private sector. And that's part of what made these such success stories. So I have nothing further to say and would happily entertain questions.
Just more of a comment, and that relates to aerosols have been replaced, the propellant's been replaced by, I think propane is a pretty common source of making aerosol cans work, but it's still a pretty lousy product delivery mechanism in my opinion. And sure, it's convenient, but there's a lot of packaging. The propane causes smog, it's flammable, so a squirt bottle or a solid application is probably a lot better way to go if you think big picture in terms of impact of a product.
So it solved the ozone problem, but doesn't solve.
Still fails to fail some other tests in my book.
Okay. Yes.
Is there then something else going on in terms of the atmosphere, in terms of UV filtering? Because the other thing that is concerning from a world health perspective is the almost doubling every 5 years of the rate of melanoma skin cancers. And it's much higher in the southern hemisphere than in the northern hemisphere.
I don't have a good explanation for that. There are UV monitors around the world. Unfortunately, not many of them were in place in the 1970 time frame to get a kind of baseline. And they're very noisy measurements. There's certainly nothing I know of in the UV exposure side, at least the sort of ozone UV exposure side, to produce something like that. Now it could be that it's just a matter of exposure of people 50 years ago. My father grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and said I used to run outside as kids and we never wore sunscreen. Now he's every year or two, he's got to go in and have another melanoma report. Whereas my generation, our parents were very diligent about sunscreen, and I hope we don't have quite the same level of problem. I'm afraid I'm unanswered. Yes?
And I just further comment on that, and I don't know, my understanding of melanoma is it's not necessarily caused by the sun and UV radiation. My understanding is basal cell carcinoma is, which is often cut off the skin and causes skin lesions. Melanoma is a malignant transformation of the pigment cells in the skin, and pigmentation, the cells that make pigmentation, we all have the same amount of, but pigmentation is obviously a lot more prominent in people in the southern hemisphere, it would seem. So I don't know if that can account for it or not.
Don't know.
Why then related, and probably nobody knows the answer to, but I know that basal cell carcinoma is more prone to be caused by UV radiation.
Well, I'm not the right kind of doctor for that. Other questions or comments?
Bill, I observed in just sort of the way you structured out some of the things. You talked about a sort of a progression. The scientific community speaks, and what was it, policymakers listen, and then business, and then the public. And I was just thinking about this morning's Bible study and thinking about Old Testament, and it's interesting that the scientists are playing the role that the prophets played in the Old Testament in terms of being the first to notice something or understand something and then speak it. And it's interesting that the prophets were really speaking to the policymakers and the rulers as well. So it's just an interesting progression that you laid out, unintentionally, I'm sure, but that in our day and age, it's the scientists who are playing one of the roles that the prophets played in the biblical tradition.
I think that's partly true. And in my work on this issue, of course, I've come in contact with a lot of environmental organizations. And I'd be inclined to say that in a lot of ways, they are the prophets. Because you read some of the ways that prophets got people's attention, and lie on one side for 20 days or whatever it was, and or walk around with torn garments and shouting in the streets and so on. This sort of attention-getting, sometimes extreme statements. That's a role that environmental organizations are comfortable playing. And a lot of scientists are likely to just say, here's my paper that explains why we're destroying the ozone layer, kind of leave it at that.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's always been a reluctance of scientists to really engage with policymakers and say, you've got to solve this problem. This is really serious. And in fact, within the scientific community, there's a fair amount of scorn and disdain for people who are too out there about what they think should be done.
But I wonder if there's a place for God speaking even through the data.
Well, I think there is, but there's also a role for passion, mm-hmm. and that goes beyond equations and analysis and peer-reviewed papers. Yes.
In your next series or so, E.L. Wilson talks a lot about positive things in his book of what we can do, but with 6.5 billion people on Earth and how China is now taking on aspects of, buying cars, all the different great abilities we have as Americans, I don't see a lot of the changes, especially when our current administration chooses not to address Kyoto or other issues like that.
Well, I hope to put a slightly more positive spin on things in the next few days, especially on Thursday. But you're right that these are huge global problems, and that the role of the developing world is very important, and that's part of why some in the U.S. have been very reluctant to take any aggressive steps. It's because you look at the next 25 years, and China and India are likely going to overtake us as, for example, global emitters of carbon dioxide. So there are certainly a range of issues, and we'll get to some of that. Yes?
Concerning global warming, I've sort of felt that what I've seen in the media is, we've warmed up 1 degree. Doesn't get me very excited, except that then I read that, in the Caribbean, 1 degree is enough to kill the coral and things, and is responsible for many of the coral reefs down in the Virgin Islands sort of being destroyed. But a month ago, we were up in Juneau, and it wasn't all like your cartoon. There are beaches. You don't set out like they did.
No.
Yeah.
Certainly.
However, things like the Mendenhall Glacier is receding very much every year. It's a major problem. And we learned that there are some places in Alaska where the temperature's gone up 14 degrees. That's a lot. That's enough to cause a lot of glacier melt. And even around Holden Village, if you go up the Lyman Glacier, which I've been going up to since I was a little kid, when I first started going up, it was a very large glacier, and it calved off into Upper Lyman Lake. Now the glacier is receded from Upper Lyman Lake, and it's very small. Every few years when I go up, you see this Lyman Glacier shrinking. So global warming is, I think, a much more serious problem than a lot of us have been led to believe by the media that say, it's 1 degree.
Yeah, 1 degree sounds in some ways trivial, in some ways maybe a little appealing, but yeah, you're quite right. There are a lot of examples of dramatic responses to that 1 degree global change, and that's how we'll spend the next three days. So I hope you can join me, and thank you all for coming. I think we better adjourn to Vespers.
Thank you.
And remember to visit the bookstore and check out these stores.
Okay. What's the blue one called?
Stormy Weather.
Yeah.
Those are your favorite.
I heard about that.
And if you want to talk about it, I'll see you right now.